Hello, this is the 40th episode of the Creative Flow podcast series hosted by Anthony Bellani and Kim Marie McKernan. It features discussions with thinkers and change agents important to the science of creativity.
Our guest today is Sue Keller Mathers, a global leader who educates the next generation of creativity experts to utilize their degrees in creativity in diverse professional and personal arenas. Sue is an associate professor at the Center for Applied Imagination, where she teaches graduate courses in creativity and is actively engaged in the International Graduate Program for Educators. She holds a BS in elementary education, an MS in creativity, and a doctorate in education in curriculum and instructions. Sue is a recognized scholar in educational change globally, infusing creative learning into teaching and learning practices, and continuing the development of the Torrance Incubation Model for Designing Learning.
Welcome, Sue.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Sue, can you please share the story of how you became involved in deliberate creativity?
Sure, I'd love to. I was teaching elementary school at McDonough 15, which is Creative Arts Magnet School in the French Quarter of New Orleans. And as part of that, I was looking for a master's program. So I dabbled in courses at different universities, Xavier University, Tulane University. And as part of a gifted ed course at Tulane, they sent us to Baton Rouge to a conference. And the speaker was Donald Treffinger. Now, Donald Treffinger was at Buffalo State in the creativity department. And when I heard him speak about creativity, I just knew that that was the piece in education that I felt was missing. And I wanted to go into that direction. And that's what I did. Went and got my master's in creativity.
You have such an impressive background teaching creative problem solving at all levels, from the elementary classroom to graduate students to international educators. Can you share insights you've learned in your career?
Yeah, you know, I fell in love with creative problem solving when I first came as a graduate student. It just seemed natural. I loved it. I loved to come up with ideas. And I also knew that ability to question and to figure out, you know, how to problem solve them was so important. As a teacher, I knew it was important to bring to students. So, you know, I've taught 5 to 75-year-olds, I guess, and globally worked with teachers and others. And it's, you know, there's more in common than there is differences, because attitude is the key. And being open to problem solving. So I'm not just teaching a process or tools. I'm helping people understand the importance of certain types of attitudes and openness to complexity, to tolerating ambiguity, to novelty. And those things are important. Now, as we know, 5-year-olds, that's easy for them. So, you know, that part of it, some things come easier to young kids. And that's why a lot of times I will tell the adults that I work with when we're learning to facilitate, if you get an opportunity to facilitate young kids, go and do it. You will learn a lot about how to facilitate everyone. You'll have different language and, you know, the flexibility of thinking and being able to deal with the kind of things, the good things that kids bring to you. So I've always said everybody should go into a kindergarten class and they'd learn a lot by doing that. What I'd like to say about that is some of my understanding of instruction. So what we understand about teaching creative problem solving is you start with things that are basic, and then you go to a more complex. Now, this is just good learning to begin with. And if you go through the lens of creative problem solving, you're talking about attitudes towards like a deferring judgment and affirmative judgment. So some of those foundational concepts to tools, teaching tools, to weaving in process, and then utilizing it for more complex and complicated things where after you've learned the process in a formal way, you have a better understanding of how to utilize it in pieces and parts. My master's project was an impact study of creative problem solving. It was of the first course that we teach in the master's program. And what I found, and what some other impact studies have found, is that people use pieces and parts. You don't see people walking around with their flip charts and their post-its and their markers. And to use the creative problem solving formally can be very impactful. But for the most part, it's that ability to diagnose where you are in a situation and then what would be needed next. So I loved when second graders would come back to me, and instead of saying, I can't, I won't, he did this, she did this, they say, how might we? And I'm like, that's it. You know, that made the biggest difference. So I think formal teaching of a creative problem solving process is important. And it's important to go beyond just tools, because the framework of creative problem solving and understanding it, especially for adults, metacognitively knowing where you are in your thinking or where others are in your situation, and then being able to diagnose and move forward productively is so important.
I forgot to mention that Sue is my professor when I was in the graduate program.
Oh, and that's right.
I cannot say enough about that comment you just made. I just did a session last week, and the thing that sets facilitators apart who have been trained in creative problem solving is that ability to adapt to the situation. Yeah. And the CEO of this major federally funded health clinic was like, thank you for adapting. You know, he was so surprised that we were able to do it. But that's something invaluable that we've learned from you, Sue.
Yeah, because if you think about the creative process, it's not just, Sidney Parnes was a perfect example. His sessions always worked. Why? Because he was constantly diagnosing what it is and making things up. You know, that's what you do. I can remember facilitating a group of school board members and parents and others, and the other facilitator and I turning to each other and saying, okay, what do we do next? Well, I have no idea. And we worked through it, and we invented something that, you know, we needed a dialogue at that point. You know, we went in and out of formal process. And so as a trained facilitator, you become, as a model goes, unconsciously skilled. You just know what to do.
That's really powerful. And what I especially love is you calling attention to the mindset piece as much as the tool piece. And it reminded me of something that I think I actually first heard when I was studying at the center, was we send kids to school with a box of 64 crayons and have them leave college with one blue pen. And if that's not a metaphor for the idea of making your mind fluid and flexible and applying that to the tools that we have, is different than just, I'm going to train you in a set of tools. Could you just elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, say that again. Ask that again.
That it's making your mindset aware of being fluid and flexible is as important as this set of tools that are on the flip chart of the diamond and the line of, you know, the steps and stages, et cetera. Tell me more about that from your perspective.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I'll talk to students about, particularly in the third creative problem solving class, is if you're going to go and work with a group, okay, if it's a formal creative problem solving facilitation, let's say, you're going to meet with the client ahead of time, you're going to try and get a feel for what the place is like, you're going to think about if you can meet other people, you're doing things that help set the climate. And especially at the beginning. So let's say you go into a session and, you know, how you set it up, what you say, the way that you ask people to interact with each other, all begins to set up that situation where there's at least, even if you're new to them, a certain level of trust. And if I've got a client, I worked with a client that hadn't normally given up. I understood that the client didn't often give up ownership. And this client said they would give some ownership to the group. Now I'm there and I'm saying to the group, you're going to have input and these are going to be considered and this is the next step. And so then it's important for me to turn to the client and say, that's correct, right? What ownership piece are you giving this group? Because they need to hear that person say that so that they feel like they have a say in it. So there's all kinds of things that we do to try and make it what's the word you would use? An authentic and an appropriate situation and bring as much of a creative climate forward as we can, given that we're often an outsider. But that importance of here's how we're going to act together today. And here are not only that, here's what they're saying they're going to do with what you do afterwards, which is probably more important because having worked in a lot of schools, if they're not used to being heard and they're used to being asked for ideas, they're not going to be with me because they're thinking it's more of the same, that, you know, big deal. Here's the idea box. We put our ideas in and they ignore them. So I have to upfront as a facilitator, make sure that that's not going to happen or I'm not going to work with them. Because, my integrity is on the line here as well. So attitude Absolutely. On all of our parts.
It goes right back to the three I's and assuring that the people in the room do have influence. Thank you. Well, tell us more about your current projects, including your recent celebration of the legacy of Ruth Noller. And if you could also tell for our listeners just who Ruth is.
Oh, you know, I love talking about Ruth. So, well, in the fall, I received a sabbatical. And the idea was I really wanted to look at, I love the history of creativity. I think in order to know the present and the future, you must understand the history. And you must understand the past. So I was going to study 11 of the scholars who helped build the field. And I started working on that. And then I was given the opportunity to write a chapter in an edited collection on Calvin Taylor. Now, Calvin Taylor from Utah did a series of scientific conferences early on in the field, like the 50s and 60s, to help build the field. But he also came up with a multiple talent approach. And so I listened to, we have in our digital commons, audio of Calvin Taylor talking at the Creative Problem Solving Institute. And so I listened to that and then wrote about his perspectives on creativity and education, and then also current perspectives. So that's how it started. Then I walked over to the Creative Studies Library and we're putting together this innovation suite. And we have this amazing, you know, the Osbornes and the Parnes gave a significant amount of money. So we have this display, beautiful display for Osborne and this beautiful display for Parnes. We have visuals up on the wall. And I said, wait a minute, there is a third person who was a seminal thinker and developer of our academic degree and creative problem solving through the Creative Education Foundation. And that's Ruth Noller, who was the second woman computer programmer in the country, worked on the Mach 1 sequence control calculator at Harvard during World War II as part of Navy Waves, went on to become a mathematician, fell in love with creativity. So I completely switched and I said, my focus needs to be on Ruth and hearing her voice. And so through a Faculty Student Association grant, I was able to do interviews of many of her students who are obviously still with us, Ruth isn't, and able to begin to put together some materials that will showcase her in our innovation suite. And so that's been my focus, and I'll be working on, I'll have a premiere in May of several videos that will be a compilation of those voices of her students, which is a lot of fun.
Wonderful. So You've also done a lot of work helping others to use the Torrance incubation model. Can you share some success stories you have? And if you could, please also explain the model for those who may not be familiar.
Well, another one of my loves, right? You know, bringing out women in creativity and talking about the Torrance incubation model. So I love curriculum. My doctorate's in curriculum. And when Mary Murdoch, who was a graduate of the Torrance Center, she was taught by E. Paul Torrance, the incubation model of teaching and learning, brought it to Buffalo State, I fell in love with this. Because as a teacher, it's a good learning model with a beginning, middle, and end, just like any other learning model, but it had more power to it. It had more structure to set purpose and motivation up front, to dig the learners deep into their content and to connect it to things to go beyond, as well as the only one of only two that I know of, models that weave creativity in so that we could teach for creativity while we teach content. And I fell in love with it. I wanted to teach for creativity. Sometimes I wanted to just teach creativity. But when I was teaching, especially in the elementary school or even in grad school, I'm teaching other concepts. I'm able to weave creativity in and teach for creativity while I teach that content. So that's a little bit about what it is. So when I first started, I really felt this was a teaching model, and that's what it originated as. But as I taught graduate students and others, it was not only meaningful and important for teachers, it was trainers. It was any time that people were presenting to make a more powerful presentation. So it was much wider use than just using it for educators. Anytime someone is educating or bringing forward creative learning, this model is important. So as an example, I do work with international school educators as an adjunct for the International Graduate Programs for Educators. And I heard in January, I did a course overseas, and I heard from the director. And the director said, this has an impact. Your course has an impact. And the course focuses on the Torrance incubation model, Tim. She said, I'm seeing students that are more engaged and my teachers are more engaged. The content outcomes are richer and I'm seeing changes in school environment. And this is a director who's into the schools. And I hear the same thing from my educators. People are more excited. They want to engage. And when you can engage them, obviously they're more apt to be present and ready to learn. And that's what the Torrance incubation model does up front. In my graduate classes, I had a student who wasn't interested in the history of creativity. She had to take this course over the summer and it was a history of creativity and blah, blah, blah. Well, now she's like, it was the best course ever. And it was a chance, Cindy Burnett and I had a chance to team teach it. And it was delivered through the Torrance incubation model. So this person learned the content and remembers the content only because the delivery of it was so engaging and because the creativity skill. So for example, one of the creativity skills that was often weaved in was visualize it rich and colorfully. And if you can see it, then you often will remember it better. So there were a lot of strategies that were used that helped the learners engage, understand at a deeper level, and remember. So basically it helps content come alive.
I too feel like Torrance was really a lovely add to tools of creative problem solving. It almost, like you said, it adds color and depth to the tools themselves. And you described that in a really nice way. Thank you. You've been steeped in the world of research and education and practice of creativity. How do you see creativity progressing into the future?
You know, having been in the field since the 80s, you see these waves. And the waves constitute an awareness and appreciation for creativity education. And I've seen them come up and down, and there's been materials developed and research around it, and it continues to go up. But we're on a much, much steeper curve this time going up in a good way. And part of it is all of the reports coming out, 21st century skills, creativity, creative thinking, critical thinking, communicating, all of these things that as researchers and trainers, we can point to as some deliberate aspects of creativity and the need for creativity training. So it's just been really exciting. And my wish for creativity in the future is not only to continue in that, but, you know, my first love was education. So we've always said, wouldn't it be great if there was a greater emphasis on creativity in the schools? And it's always been pockets, and it comes and it goes. And wouldn't it be great if it was more consistent? And it's about showcasing talents and understanding the wide range of talents. We get students who come back for master's degrees, they hated school. They didn't think they didn't do well in school, but in life they blossomed and they're amazing. The things, and so they come back having a better understanding of the ways they are creative and the way they're smart. They never knew it. So wouldn't it be great if every kid grew up knowing that their creative abilities were present and appreciated? And there's one other piece to that I've always thought was important. The ability to understand others who are different. I think oftentimes we are in silos. So, you know, my response often is, I wish every kid could have a international experience through their schooling. And the reason is that I think it's a small world. And the less we know about each other and can tolerate and have some understanding of differences, the scarier the world is. And I think creativity can make things a lot less scary and a lot more tolerant.
What a beautiful vision, Sue. I love it. I want to live in that world.
Me too.
So to close, we ask each of our speakers, tell us about your creative flow, Sue.
Oh, creative flow. I love that. You know, that's one of those things that if you can develop your ability to get into the creative flow, what a wonderful thing. And I'm always thinking about thinking. And so when I was younger, not just a kid, even in my young adult, I was an avid runner and I absolutely love nature. And so those ahas would come, those ahas. Now, I'm going to frame this whole idea of creative flow into the Torrance incubation model. When the aha came, or when some initial thinking happens when I was running or in the woods or gardening, I was in two places in the Torrance incubation model. I was either in the beginning and the warming up and the anticipation, or I was in the extending aspect. So, but something in the middle, that middle part is where the creative flow comes. So I'll talk about that. Probably my biggest example is the hardest thing I ever did, my dissertation. And because I understood the Torrance incubation model, I knew where I was. So I did a qualitative study of 11 older women of extraordinary creative accomplishment. Here I am. I've already done the warming up. I've set the purpose and motivation. I'm in the middle of the Torrance incubation model, and everything's all over the place. I have posters up. I have different colors, I'm walking and talking with the women and listening and trying to put it together. And I thought, there is no way I will ever be able to write anything from this. Well, when I take it to the Torrance incubation model, I knew that I was in the point where I had to get out of a locked door, where I had to cut a hole in a cloud to see through, some of the metaphors they use. During that same time, though, as I'm walking and talking, that's creative flow, because I'm working through that. There's nothing else going on. I don't know what's going on outside. I don't know what time it is. I eat the whole time, so that's not a problem, which is unfortunate, but you know, I munch while I, but that was total creative flow. And it comes together that way. A smaller example is the Taylor chapter I just did. And I do the same thing. I am very visual to get into my creative flow. I am also somebody who walks. And so that movement is important. So I knew in order to put together a really powerful piece on Taylor, I needed to prep. That's the beginning of the Torrance incubation model. And then I needed to do all the strategies that allow me to get to that creative flow so that I'm lost in it. I'm hearing his voice as I go along, which was absolutely amazing. And so I think that particularly with very, very intriguing things that I'm very motivated to do, things that are complex and difficult, I now understand how to prepare for that creative flow, give myself the opportunity to get into that situation. I take over in a whole room and don't let anybody in. And everything's up. And then I know how to connect that. So when I was done with my dissertation, I did a lot of presentations. And I did some writing and other things, but I knew there were things to go beyond it. So that's kind of, it's a bit more than just the creative flow, but I wanted you to see how I think is, you know, as I'm into my sixth decade on this world, I now know if I want to do something that puts me in that, there has to be some, it has to be the right kind of thing that I'm working on. And I need to do the things that I know work for me to put me in that creative flow.
And, you know, I think you're the first guest that actually talked about deliberately getting into the flow and how you do it. So thank you for sharing that.
My exact thought, Kim, I believe, add another word to what you just said, is that you're the first person to talk about engineering the creative flow, or most people just sort of, oh, I just find myself in it and then blah, 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 blah. So knowing it's indicative of what you've done in your entire career, where you, especially your purpose of not only appropriating creative problem solving in Torrance, but then not only teaching it, but assuring that the teachings and the lessons get picked up. And the kudos that you got from your people in Europe is proof of that, that you, your lessons not only were delivered, but they made a difference. And how much more powerful can you be as an educator than that?
And that's why we keep teaching. You know, it's like the song, Remember Why You Came. You know, the band goes on again. Well, this is why teachers can continue, even when things are hard. And I often talk to public educators about that things are going to be hard. But every once in a while, that piece comes back to you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. You brought such a richness. I've known you for years. And all the people that I've known that we brought on the show, I always come away with so much newness about who you are and what you do. So thank you very much.
Thank you. This has been great.
And thank you for listening. This is Anthony Bellani.
And Kimberly McKernan.
We invite you to tune in again to the Creative Flow series. We hope you will translate your creative flow into action, and that your actions will change the world.